From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Dressing for a costume party or a masquerade, one might think of the Elizabethans, those elaborately dressed men and women of England under the rule of Elizabeth I, who reigned from 1558 till 1603. One way of learning about the Elizabethans is through historical novels, two examples of which are Death of the Fox and The Succession by George Garrett. Both of Mr. Garrett's novels are set in Elizabethan England as recreations of the last days of Sir Walter Raleigh and of Elizabeth I. George Garrett is a professor of English at the University of Michigan.
With a few exceptions, I've never really enjoyed much, at least modern historical fiction. I grew up on Scott, and I still think Scott is wonderful, and James Fenimore Cooper.
Now, this is the man that Mark Twain said should be banished from the
right,
language. What about that?
Well, you know, I don't know exactly what he had in mind. He's a little closer to Scott than we are, and I reckon he was annoyed at some of the big brush, as they call it, or the braggadocio of the Scott novels. And also, I think maybe Mark Twain had in mind the effect.
Do you think that's a bad judgment? Do you think that historical fiction automatically implies a romantic view of reality? How, for instance, do you approach it?
Well, not necessarily. I don't think it does. I do think that the main form of the genre of historical fiction that we have around now, which I, for the most part, vigorously avoid, is the historical romance.
Now, are you talking about the what are they called, the Harlequin sorts of things?
Well, there's that, and then, you know, your basic sword and bosom historical story. Or there's some very good ones, too. I just find, basically, my own feeling about it, it's been better put, but the big influence on my thinking about this has been Shelby Foote, who is a wonderful novelist, but also written one of the great works of history of our time, the big three-volume history of the Civil War. And Foote, it worried me what he might think about my doing a historical novel, because he's a friend and also a kind of conscience. He doesn't think that when the facts and information are available, that it is honest to distort these, to make of a character whatever you please in a sort of fictional way. Narrative history, which could include, as his does, fictional devices, but is absolutely accurate, is sort of his model. But the reason he let me off the hook on writing about Elizabethans is that they were much more than anybody else until almost right now, very much concerned with image, with disguises, with wearing masks, with dressing up, with acting out. And they're very enigmatic people. They made fictions of themselves. So that in one sense, it could be argued that the only, I don't think I would want to do that against some heavy historians, but maybe the only effective way to deal with Elizabethans is in the medium which they existed in, namely fiction.
Well, do you think that that provided you with an entrance or a rationale for writing about them that might otherwise not have existed?
I think it did, actually. The first time that I ran across this, I was trying to do a biography of Sir Walter Raleigh, and in my ignorance, I thought it had been about 50 years since there had been any, and somebody noticed this in a book, and I, not realizing myself, not being sophisticated enough to know that by the time something is in a book, an introduction to a book, other people are doing it, I had been interested in the poetry of Raleigh, and that since he was compounded of stage elements at that time, why couldn't he be treated just as effectively, maybe more so, as a fictional character than as a real figure in a conventional sense. You didn't know what you were looking for. I soon discovered that. You have no idea at any given time, because one thing relates to another. what it is, what sorts of information you need to know to feel at ease with those people.
Well, if you have something that you're looking for, don't you leave yourself open to the charge that you are bringing to the past a bias of the
present?
I'm sure. So, did you worry about that?
I did to this extent. Yes, I did worry that. And the way that I wanted to handle that was this, that I did not look for, I deliberately did not look for parallels or points of interest from the 20th century point of view. I figured I am a 20th century person. I am writing for 20th century people, speaking to them. Any other description of this is false. Therefore, it isn't necessary for me to look for the obvious contact points. They are not, let us not look at them as 20th century people in funny clothes. Lacking the technological perfections. Mm-hmm. Let us instead look at them as if they were on another planet. Let us look at their alien and strange characteristics from our point of view, and let those be brought forward, and that would counteract, to an extent, imaginatively counteract the inherent biases of a 20th century person mm-hmm. trying to write about them.
George, if you didn't have a particular 20th century bias that you brought to writing about the world of the Elizabethans, did you have what might be called a formula, something, for instance, that would correspond to Hawthorne's notion of the romance, that sort of shadowy middle ground that the artist uses to create the past?
No, I didn't, but I had, when you mentioned that, I had another little rule of the road, a couple of rules to help me, uh-huh. whether they... to do it. Presumably they helped some. One was that I would not use any of the notes and materials I took during the actual writing of the thing. That is to say, I would try to remember both general things and details so that if you want a model for it, it was more like a final exam than a term paper. The idea being that memory itself, vague as it might be, would give it an authenticity, that it was part of my experience, if I remembered it, be more authentic than if I had worked with blocks of material like a grad student doing a term paper.
So it was really novelistic in that sense.
Yeah, I think so.
You avoided what one of my recent panelists on a Soundings program calls the heavy hand of research.
Well, not entirely, because you got two problems there. One of them is you've worked so hard and you've discovered things and you just want them in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are places I can see where I was just guilty of throwing in. The other side of it is that in the genre of historical fiction, and in historical fiction generally, unless it is about a period of history that for one reason or another is extremely familiar to everybody, writer and reader, it's a little bit like having to create your own place for a story. Mm-hmm. The reader expects and demands, in a sense, a certain amount of information all the time.
Well, you said it was like beings from another planet.
Right.
You have to create a new setting.
So you have to create the environment, the climate, and other things. And you also have to get, they like to feel, and I understand this, this is part of the rhetoric, part of the suspense of an historical fiction, that information itself is dealt out like a hand of cards all the way through.
Hmm.
So there gives you one opportunity to do things with research. And I tried to do it in the most natural way that I could, so that it would derive from a scene. For instance, there's a famous story about Raleigh where his son, he had an outrageous son, Watt, the older son, who got such a bad reputation as being a rowdy that the old man didn't want to take him to an important dinner party. But he took him anyway when the boy promised to be really good.
Mm-hmm.
He got there and was really good for about half the thing. And then he told a really grotesque and funny story, but it was at his father's expense. And it was at a moment of quiet. Everybody heard it. And Raleigh hit him in the face. He was sitting side by side, slapped him in the face. Everyone waited to see what the rowdy boy would do, and he just laughed and turned to the man next to him and hit him in the face.
Oh, my star.
And said, pass it on. It will come round to my father anon. Well, that's too good a story to leave out. Mm-hmm. And that was not one that I forgot right away.
Whether it's apocryphal or not.
Now, so I use it in a way. It's the only place in the whole Raleigh book where I mention the basic fact that all the men wore their hats at table. Because in the description of the striking, in both cases, the hats fall off. Mm-hmm. And so that struck me as an example of how you get a piece of information when you describe somebody being slapped and his hat falls off, and then it happens to the other man's hat. The reader begins to infer that everybody was wearing hats, and they realize this is, and that nobody else was reacting that this was unusual, so that was probably the custom of the time.
George, tell me, let's talk specifically where our discussion is about historical fiction, and you've written books about the Elizabethans from that standpoint. Tell me, how foreign would Queen Elizabeth be to us?
I'll give you an example from her youth, when she was not yet queen. She was suspected, and it appears historically that this was with good reason, to be involved with a plot to overthrow her sister, Mary Tudor, Bloody Mary. Uh-huh. And she was brought back from, she'd been banished, as it were, from court anyway, and was living out in the country. She was brought back to London to be investigated, to have this take place. Now, the key thing for her was, first of all, to let things cool off a little bit. And secondly, and this is somebody about 20 years old, is playing for her life, like completely alone, and evidently nobody else knew what any of her thinking was. She had no advisors on this, her own theory, but it gets more interesting. Her main purpose, if she could get to see her sister, she figured she could talk herself out of it, as she had done other things. And she always was able to talk to her sister and get out. And, of course, her sister was surrounded by advisors who were going to make very sure that Queen Elizabeth didn't, or Princess Elizabeth at that time, did not get to see her. Now, she asked permission to write a quick note to her sister. That note still exists. It's kind of interesting because it is very emotional, and it even has teardrops on it. Okay. It is also very clever in that she took all the parts that were blank and drew lines through them so no one could write anything else beside what she had written on this piece of paper. This took just a few minutes, and they kept telling her to hurry up, but she did. Those few minutes allowed the tide to turn so that she couldn't go down to the Tower of London for another 6 hours till the tide was back the way it was.
A very, very smart young woman. Huh?
Now, but what? Think about that. That somewhere in her mind, she couldn't see the river from where that house was. She had noted the tide when she arrived at Whitehall Palace and kept track on 6 hour intervals, roughly. She knew roughly where the tide was, and the fact that if she stalled these two fellows, which she did, long enough, it would be too late to go under London Bridge, and they'd have to go in the morning. Now, the morning was perfect as far as she was concerned, because the main thing she did not want was for it to be her to be secretly put in the tower. She needed people to know this, coming back to this idea of popularity. It was too dark at midnight to take her, so they had to wait for morning. Dawn came. It's Palm Sunday. She put on a very, very plain outfit, thus, in a way, identifying herself with the Puritan element of the populace of London and distinguishing herself from the court. It was raining, and they rowed her down the river, and she refused to get in under, out of the rain, into the little canopied cabin, but stood out on the boat so that everybody going to and from early service on the riverbank saw this barge with the Princess Elizabeth headed for the Tower of London.
So this was a turning of the tide in more than one sense.
Oh, yeah. Now you have to think about, absolutely, this is a woman, the desperation that she was in. Mm-hmm. Then she arrived at the Tower of London, and all the details of this are full of gestures made to be reported. She didn't want to go in when she got there. and then she fell down and knelt in the stones, and this is, it made some reference to her mother having been taken there and executed, and pulled out all the stops in a way, and all of that probably saved her life. But she, that's very mysterious, the whole thing, because it indicates an ability to act out, turn on tears when she had to act out various things, and at the same time be perfectly cool, calculating machine.
George, let me present you with something that's just utterly anachronistic. Okay. It sounds like she was aware that there might be a TV camera somewhere.
Oh, that's exactly what I meant about these people conveying images.
Yeah.
They didn't have... They acted much the same way in that sense that contemporary figures do, in which we have to ask ourselves, you know, every once in a while an article comes along about one of the candidates. Who are the real any of these candidates? We don't know. They present an image in front of a camera. In the absence of the camera, this small central group of the court and the few thousand people who mattered, I guess, at the center of things, plus the population of London, were treated to actual spectacles of people performing much the way they do today for public performance in front of a television camera.
So it wasn't a matter of human nature so much as the difference in methods of distribution.
I think absolutely, yeah. No, so I didn't even feel a need to stress that, because they were constantly on. Mm-hmm. They were constantly being an image.
Yeah. As one of our anchormen says, the camera never blinks. It's always there.
I'll give you an example of the strangeness of that period, though. They're kind of a very small thing, a couple of things, but one that interests me a lot is the fact that their clothes were really quite wonderful. They spent more money on clothes than we do by far. They dressed up for the men and the women. It was like an automobile or something, about that price usually.
Almost.
What they dressed up. In fact, the courtiers in those paintings were sometimes wearing $250,000 worth of clothing, which is kind of odd. But none of those clothes at any level of society, with a few exceptions like just flat work clothes or academic gowns, except for those, everything you had required at least one person, probably more, to help you get dressed. This doesn't necessarily mean, it explains why they had lots of servants and things.
It also says something about a social order.
It does. It also says something about communal. If everybody needs somebody else to help our whole theory is more and more independence.
Yeah.
We wouldn't like it if we had to have our neckties tied every morning by somebody. Apparently, this had never occurred to them. They had never conceived of a social situation in which there wouldn't be somebody who in a communal sense or tribal sense or whatever, there wouldn't be somebody there to help you. There's an indication that they had very little privacy and never desired it very much. The indications are that except for bathing, which they did more of than we think.
That's a myth.
It was later that they stopped bathing, but in those days.
And why, parenthetically?
I think it has to do with the breakup of the big, when the Industrial Revolution came in, and then the sense of many small houses instead of one big house where hundreds of people live.
Yeah.
Different kind of community developed, and it was more trouble. But in those great big houses, almost it's amazing, even small nuclear families had 30 people. A simple parson like George Herbert or something maybe looked after a dozen, 15 or 20 people all sort of living together.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation about historical fiction. My guest is George Garrett, a novelist and professor of English at the University of Michigan. Mr. Garrett is the author of two novels about Elizabethan England, Death of the Fox and The Succession, which respectively recount the final days of Sir Walter Raleigh and of Elizabeth I, the British monarch who ruled England from 1558 till 1603. George, we've been talking about the Elizabethans. You've been describing the social, the cultural circumstances surrounding Elizabeth herself. Tell me about Sir Walter Raleigh. What sort of a gentleman was he?
Well, he interests me as a wonderful mixture of many elements, which in that sense is kind of a representative Elizabethan, although I think he earned that by living out of the age and into the next age. Also, I think she, from the, you know, the story about the cloak.
Yeah, throwing the cloak down on the
Now, there are only two. This is probably entirely apocryphal, but it fits his character, in a sense, because it is such a much more significant gesture than we take it to be. We assume it to be a gesture of Lord Fauntleroy-esque good manners.
Yeah, but you were referring a moment ago to the expense, the wealth of the investment in clothes.
That's right. Well, a Spanish cape, I remember reading somewhere that the exact cost of one at the year that he's supposed to have done that in the 1580s, that a cape would cost £80. Now, that doesn't seem like very much to us, but because prices have changed a great deal.
But what was it then?
Well, unless you think, it's hard to put it in actual money, but look at it this way. A master carpenter, craftsman, got an annual salary on which he lived rather well. And this was considered a quite adequate wage, and he was a member of the upper middle class, got £8 a year.
And this would have been 10 times?
10 huh? times the salary. Now, this was a poverty-stricken young man with no offices and no source of income, living on debts, who threw an 80-pound cape and ruined it in a mud puddle. And I'm sure it couldn't have the kinds of materials they had, and it wouldn't recover from that.
No wonder she was impressed with him.
She thought he was a pretty impressive. And that one gesture, that he would throw away something very valuable for her, in a way, he'd thrown his life away.
George, give me an example of something from one of your historical fictions about the Elizabethans, something maybe that's representative, evocative of the way Elizabethans lived.
Well, maybe what I can do is read a little account of the execution of the Earl of Essex.
All right.
Not that they did enjoy executions, as a matter of fact, as a kind of stage production.
Did that make them barbarians, just parenthetically?
Maybe to our point of view, it does. It had some kind of festive quality to it on both sides.
Oh, my stars.
It gave the man who was being executed an opportunity to shine briefly also.
to go out
go out with a few words and a certain dignity. But there are a number of aspects in this little passage which I hope are characteristically Elizabethan, one of them having to do with the difficulty the Earl of Essex had in removing some of his clothing, because
they were great dressers.
They were indeed, and he was all dressed up, and somebody had helped him get dressed, but you had to be helped to get undressed too, or otherwise it was extremely clumsy. And the other aspect is a certain kind of attitude toward life and death that they had. In some way, they didn't doubt for an instant that the moment of death was a slight interruption in an eternal life. They really didn't have any doubt that it's quite clear that this they weren't any more eager than we are, I think, to go through that moment. But they seemed to have been absolutely certain, without any question, that they eternity was where they were living.
Well, that's a healthy attitude, I suppose.
The person who's speaking in this passage, or who is doing the thinking, the you, as described as the you, is a tough old soldier, something of a spy, quite a different sort of person than Essex, who doesn't even approve of Essex that much, who is here recollecting what happened, or invoking what happened. He's riding home. He's in an inn. You sit in your chamber, eating supper, watching rain lash and splatter against the windows. There's fire in the fireplace, and your cloak and clothing are steaming dry on a rack set close to it. Fire in the fireplace and food and wine in your belly. Your eyes are heavy with weary comfort, large, clean bed inviting. And who knows, it may rain all tomorrow, too, forcing you to stay here another day. You sip wine and stare at the flames. And now you are on the shores of sleep, can let go and sleep at any moment you want to. There, dreaming, lax on the edge of sleep, you picture how it was for him, for Essex, that Ash Wednesday morning. Gray February, cold wind blowing in gusts, damp in the air from the river. See how he comes now, lightly guarded from the Devlin Tower out onto the green, all in black, black velvet cloak, black satin suit, black as the glossy ravens there. Tall man with preachers walking on each side of him, praying. It must have been as he imagined it would be, which would be a comfort. So long as it was not beyond imagining, then he was not without hope. He might live. He was not afraid, had not been afraid of death, and did not fear it either as he walked to the scaffold and mounted it, not out of logic and false hopes, but purely and simply because until that moment he had always borne a charmed life. So that the first part, where he stood tall and black before them to speak, was not so difficult as a stranger to these things might conceive. He says the words he has by heart loud and clear, so that they can be heard and reported, acknowledging both sin and guilt, and asking pardon, though not asking for mercy. I confess I have received an honorable trial, and I am justly condemned, and I desire all the world to forgive me, even as I do freely and from my heart forgive all the world. Finishing his words, he began to remove his cloak and ruff, with difficulty, awkwardly, for now he had need of a servant to help him, and there was none. There, you think, there is the turning point, the moment as awkward and alone he struggled with his own clothing, clothing made to be removed by other pairs of hands. That was his Gethsemane, ungracefulness of it, trembling fingers, knowing then that his lifelong charms had failed him, that all of his luck and magic had vanished, knowing what other lesser men learn early and always know, knowing that he would die, that nothing could save him, that all of his life had been a stage play, and this alone, himself on a cold morning in a windy place, set with chaplain and headsman on a scaffold, this only was real. Knowing, too, without words for it, that other men, lesser men, had always known this truth, knowing that his magic, his fortune, his charms had been rooted in ignorance. Now his fingers were sure, even as he was pretending to be sure, and he removed his black doublet to reveal, theatrical to the very last, a brilliant blood-red waistcoat. Then, without any binding or blindfold, he lay down, placing his head on the smooth chopping block, and repeated softly, together with the minister and some others, words from the 51st Psalm. Thou shalt purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Thou shalt wash me, and I shall be whiter than the snow. Thou shalt make me to hear of joy and gladness, that the bones which thou hast broken may rejoice. Come, Lord Jesus, and receive my soul. At the last, even the executioner bungled. It took him 3 full strokes before he managed one right and severed the earl's handsome head from his body. Well, it was harder for him to die, heavy with the wound of sudden knowledge and the loss of a lifetime's illusions, than it would be for you or for me or for many another who has never had any good reason to imagine himself to be a god.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. My guest was George Garrett, a novelist and professor of English at the University of Michigan, discussing historical fiction and reading a passage from his novel about Elizabethan England entitled The Succession. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about Islam and commerce in the Middle East. My guests will be Shaul Bakash, a scholar at the National Humanities Center, and Bruce Lawrence of Duke University. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.